If you thought the end of the series Downton Abbey would be the end of the Crawley family's adventures, a new film has arrived to prove you wrong. The movie continues the story of this very wealthy group and their loyal staff.
The large cast is reunited, from sharp-tongued dowagers to scheming butlers, and this time the king and queen are coming for a visit. I'm Glenn Weldon.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking Downton Abbey on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me and Glenn in the studio to talk about Downton Abbey is NPR's movie critic, Bob Mondello. Hi, Bob.
Hey, good to be here.
So we all went to see this film. I had actually kind of forgotten this was coming out.
Yeah.
And then there it was. Glenn, what did you think?
Well, I mean, I was a little worried going in because the series lasted for 6 seasons. And it started to lose a little momentum. I mean, I went into it thinking, am I in the mood for an entire film built around, say it with me, A Spot of Bother with the Pudding Spoons, or whatever the hell it was going to be. Turns out I totally am. This is a seamless transition. You are just right back in, doesn't miss a beat. It is Downton Abbey season 7, basically. It's bigger. It's grander. We get a drone shot of Downton in the beginning, which we never got before.
That's true.
And we also, when the names of the actors come up, there's a little sparkle on their names, like it's polished silver. And these stories are just fascinating because they defy everything I know about storytelling, everything I know about fiction, everything I know about drama, which is that conflict causes change. that someone is different at the beginning than they are at the end. But here, conflict causes mild ripples.
Yeah.
And it's not even conflict. It's a spot of bother, which is immediately met with Bob's your uncle. Like, everything's fine. So that's the two-stroke engine of these stories. It is visual comfort food at a time that I need comforting. I'm in. However, we'll talk about this more, I hope, but it does land on you a lot differently today than it did back then, because it hasn't changed, but we have.
Yeah.
I mean, the Amazon has been on fire. It's a time of conspicuous consumption that has never been more conspicuous. And if you'd have told me going in that you're going to love a film whose overarching theme is everything works out for the rich and the rich deserve it, I would have been like, nope, pass, but here we are.
Yeah. You know, in terms of what you said about change, I would argue that over the course of the series and then into the movie, there are a couple of characters, I think Lady Mary is one, Lady Edith is another one, where you do see some changes in their personalities. I think Mary has become a little bit less full of herself, and Edith has become much less feeling sorry for herself.
And assertive.
And she's become more assertive. Bob, what did you think?
Oh, I had a wonderful time. Oh, my God, I had a wonderful time. And I sort of knew it from the word trailer. When I saw that trailer and the music came in, now, I know this is silly, but the music on television has been fine and is big. The music in the trailer sounded like they brought in 400 additional musicians. It was just enormous. And I thought, okay, that's what you do when you're making a movie, right? You make it bigger.
I want to hear it. I want to hear it, because we actually have it. So, Jessica, play us the TV theme.
Okay, not bad. It's substantial.
All right, and let's hear the movie theme. You are right, Bob.
Oh, yeah.
It's big. Uh-huh. And everything about this movie is big. And I also knew it from the moment the film started. You remember, it starts with somebody scratching on a piece of paper.
Yes.
And you see this pen on a piece of paper, and it's scribbling. And then you see the blotting of the paper, and then you see the folding of the paper into an envelope, and it goes down a hallway. And by the time it arrives, you have seen 4 modes of transportation and from 1920s and... Yeah. A lawnmower from the 1920s. Yeah. And I was just like, oh, this is what I love.
Yeah.
It.
And I think without spoiling anything, and also we said this in the intro, so I hope it's not spoiling anything. The basic, someone asked me yesterday, what is the plot of this? And I said, well, the overarching plot is the king and queen are coming to visit Downton Abbey.
Right.
But then, of course, there are 20 subplots.
Nice.
And I do think, I had a great time at this movie, too. I came back and what I said was, never have my expectations been so precisely met.
Exactly. Like,
it's not necessarily, you know, I didn't come out of it thinking, like, oh, boy, you know, I was so excited. But, you know, but I did come out thinking I've missed watching this show, not for a terribly long time, but, you know, I have missed watching this show and I've missed watching some of these characters. And I do think it's so itself. There's always the Barrow gay story involving he's constantly surprised by the existence of other gay people.
Yep.
There's a repetitiveness to that, but that was always true of the show as well. The thing that impressed me the most as I watched the opening titles was, wow, they really did get this whole cast back together. Mm-hmm. But it is conspicuous as you watch it that you can sort of go through and say, like, some of these people did not shoot for very long on this movie, right? I sat there last night thinking, I feel like anybody who really liked the show would have to be satisfied
of
by
course.
This movie. But then I realized that's not quite true, because if there's only one thing about the show that you really like if you're like, I just like Lady Edith and I love watching Lady Edith, or if you're an I love Lady Mary and I only like watching Lady Mary, you might not be satisfied because nothing gets much time.
Right.
Because you're talking about a 2-hour film that's trying to serve, it's not like an episode of the television show where one week it can be Lady Edith and another week somebody else.
Right, but everybody gets a moment, right? I mean, a very precise moment where you get the line that you have always wanted that character to say. I felt as if they were, you know, this was carefully scripted so that everyone could have, not a farewell exactly, but a stop. A stop, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, everybody got this ties up their thing in a neat little bow. But I do think that a royal visit was the perfect plot. Because if you are a process nerd, and a big part of the appeal of this show is seeing how it happened, how it works.
Right.
These
incredibly complicated etiquette questions and all that
exactly.
stuff.
Exactly. What they're doing is they're introducing an entirely new dynamic that we've never seen before. In 6 years of the show, we just keep seeing the same sort of iterations, but this brings something that is actually almost conflict.
Well, and you're bringing
approaching conflict.
And you're bringing in a whole, so much of the show is about the levels, the social levels, sort of the upstairs and the downstairs. And now you're bringing in people who are well above the upstairs so that they also have to kind of be worrying about doing the right thing. And they're not just in charge all the time.
Yeah.
They're also trying to figure out how to impress people who are substantially more important than they are, which has not always been something the show did.
Yeah.
You have to be something of a monarchist, I think, to find this fun. I do think it's a great thing for process nerds, but you also sort of have to buy into the idea that it's terribly exciting to the staff. You know, the idea that the king and the queen are coming, so you're going to be able to sort of serve them and please them and all that stuff is the, you know, that begins as the stakes for the staff.
Yeah. Exactly. And again, this is about reinforcing the status quo, except it's really high status quo. And there is a petty theft subplot, a pilferer subplot. And when the pilferer gets cornered, they get this, because of the monarchism, just it's throughout this script, they get this moralistic speech about how, well, why do you do it? Do you think that just because you can't have something, no one should? And I was like, that is not the proposition that's on the table. That is the wrong question. And so the pilferer gets to say, no, I just think I should have it, which is like, I raise my fist in solidarity. It's like, yes, because there is such a thing of these people are right, the way it has always been done must be the way it continues. And it's just, well, that kind of hits you the wrong way.
What sometimes. I want to see is Downton Abbey 2, the sequel to this. I've decided that it should be in 1953.
Oh, okay.
I have visions of what would happen after the fact.
As we mentioned before, everybody gets a little final thing to say, and there is such overwhelming finality in everything everybody says. I can't imagine they're going to do this again. This felt to me like we are done.
I think you're probably right, but
I don't know.
I'd still love to.
I felt the opposite. I felt like some of the ones that had the most finality were meant to announce, if this goes on, you won't see this character anymore.
Yeah, sure.
I felt like it meant to clear the way
in
that regard. But I do think, and this is something Glenn and I sort of talked about as we were coming out of the film, is like, I really do wonder whether this series would have been received in the same way had it started now. Because I do think that the sort of the pop culture look at extreme wealth is a little different than it was then. And I think that for some people, that was already a reason not to watch this show.
Sure.
For plenty of people, it was already, I don't care about a bunch of rich people and their rich person problems.
I got a lot of pushback when the show was on from friends who didn't like it. My reaction to them was usually, well, you know, there was upstairs, downstairs. It's not as if we haven't done this before.
No, sure. But I think now people are a little bit more, my sense is that the appetite is for a little bit more of the succession view of rich people, which is that they're all miserable monsters, as opposed to this very sympathetic portrait of kind of, well, it's on the rich to kind of be the centers of society.
The heart of the town
and provide jobs for everyone. And this look at kind of there being a class of people who will never have to do anything for themselves. I don't know whether it would be received in the same way, but I understand what you're saying, Glenn, when you say the state of the world right now.
It's
like the escapist part of the show works really well, but the fact that the escapism is through the eyes of the extraordinarily wealthy and constantly waited on and essentially exclusively white. I don't know.
This takes place in the fall of 1927, which is right getting up to, like, just button up to the Great Depression. So if there is a sequel, that would be interesting, actually, now that I say that.
There are references to things that have happened in the past. They talk about when the house was a convalescent home during the war. So they're very aware of all the history.
Your point about the Depression is a really well-taken one. That would make a better Downton 2, and maybe mine could be Downton 3 in the 50s.
Sure.
But I do think we should do the little bit of, again, service journalism. We should say, and I think I can confidently say, if you're not a Downton Abbey person from the TV show, I think this would seem so scattered that it would probably not hold together for you. Although I can't, you know, it's hard to make that judgment.
Look, I was sucked into and stuck with Downton on the small screen forever. Mm-hmm. On the big screen, it is grand and gorgeous, and every bit of embroidery is enormous, and it's just beautiful.
Yeah, it's that plus actual pomp and circumstance. You know, the royal visit comes with all this
parade,
falderal that the show does very, very well. That is what the show's for, basically.
I did enjoy it quite a lot. Good fun stuff. Tell us what you think about Downton Abbey once you get a chance to see it. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it will be time to talk about what is making us happy this week, so come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Zoom. When you can't be there in person, Zoom. Zoom is used by millions to connect face-to-face, across town, or around the world. Share files, video, anything, and connect through any device, desktop, laptop, tablet, smartphone, or conference room system. Zoom video conferencing, Zoom rooms, Zoom video webinars, and Zoom phone lets you do business at the speed of Zoom. Visit Zoom online to set up your free account today. Meet happy with Zoom.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What's Making Us Happy This Week. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
In keeping on the Downton tip, you know, Hugh Bonneville doesn't have a lot to do in this movie except look vaguely out of sorts when a servant breaches etiquette. He's great in the Paddington films. I'm a big fan of the guy. But on the 2015 television series Gallivant, he had a recurring role as a leader of a band of land pirates. And in the fourth episode of season one, he got to sing a very silly sea shanty. So if you want, if you are bullish on Bonneville and you want a little bit more out of that guy, the season one, episode four of Gallivant, which is available on Netflix right now.
All right. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Bob Mondello, what is making you happy this week?
I went to a birthday party for a lady named Alice recently, and we had the party in a restaurant. And I, as we were leaving the restaurant, I made a joke about how now this was going to be, in my head, Alice's restaurant. And only two people of the 11 in the group got the reference. And so I thought, I'm sorry, I have to reintroduce this song that was a very big deal to me in my youth before all the rest of you were born, called Alice's Restaurant.
You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant.
Now, this is by Arlo Guthrie, and back in 1967, he wrote this song. It is 18 minutes long, and it goes into trash dumping and small-town policing and all kinds of things. It formed my youth. It apparently also formed his. He was about 18 when he wrote it, and he ended up having to perform it thousands of times, and it's 18 minutes long. It's insane. So anyway, I went back and listened to it again. I love it so much, it just took me back. So that's what's making me happy.
Oh, thank you very much, Bob Mondello. Good reminder. Appreciate that. I am going to go with a film that I am always happy to revisit that was mentioned on Twitter recently by the writer and editor Rakesh Satyal, and that is the film Rachel Getting Married, which is not a new movie, but every now and then someone brings it up and I'm reminded anew of how much I like it. You can rent it on streaming. This is Anne Hathaway in maybe her best performance, I think, as a young woman coming back to her family after she's gone through a lot of personal problems. She comes back for her sister's wedding. Her sister is played by Rosemary DeWitt. Her father is played by Bill Irwin. Her kind of estranged mother is played by Deborah Winger. Everyone in this movie is wonderful. It has lovely music. Tunde Adebimpe is also in the film and sings. Tamira Gray from American Idol stands up and sings at one point. The Deborah Winger performance is spectacular. The Anne Hathaway performance is spectacular. The film is so moving. And for some reason, there are still people who have just never bumped into it. You can rent it on streaming in some places. So I would say go out and find Rachel Getting Married, directed by Jonathan Demme, an absolutely gorgeous movie and one that I am always thrilled to revisit. It's always nice to be able to just give people a good recommendation. If you've never sat down with it, sit down with it, Rachel Getting Married. And that is what is making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Glenn at G.H. Weldon. You can find Bob at Bob_Mondello. And our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. Our producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, is at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. And if you have a second and you're so inclined, do subscribe to our newsletter. That's at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all right back here next week.
When Bethany saw someone that looked a lot like her friend's boyfriend on the dating app Hinge,
I was like, oh my God, did something happen?
This week, NPR's Invisibilia dives into the tricky business of sorting the real from the fake.